Welcome to the Innovation Nation on CareerBuzz, Cairns' unique radio conversation empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations. Welcome to the Innovation Nation on CareerBuzz. Hi, I'm Stephen Armstrong, and I'm pleased to be your host today on Innovation Nation on CareerBuzz. Innovation Nation explores the intersection of the real world business practices and people's career development. We explore how individuals turn their personal passion for innovation into tangible commercial success. Thank you for tuning in this morning. Today on your show, we focus on doing business internationally during times of disruptive change in the global economy. And we're going to look at the case of Germany in the European Union. Now, nobody needs to be told we all live in an era of disruption in which powerful global forces are changing how we live and work. The rise of China, India, and other emerging economies, the rapid spread of digital technologies, the growing challenges to globalization, and in some countries, the splintering of long-held social contracts are all impacting business, the economy, and society. Now, these and other global trends offer considerable new opportunities to companies, sectors, countries, and individuals that embrace them successfully. But the downside for those who cannot keep up has also grown disproportionately. For business leaders, policymakers, and individuals, figuring out how to navigate these skewed times may require some radical rethinking. Consider Germany. Once a powerhouse, is now at an economic standstill. The economy shrank last year and it's not predicted to grow in 2024. Farmers are angry, industrial output is falling, and the government is bickering. How do small businesses and international businesses think about these changes? Well, today our guest is the right one to answer these questions. Our guest, Michael Blacklock, completed his MBA from the University of Chicago in 1975, and he commenced with a management position with a large U.S. Chicago-based multinational automotive manufacturer. He is a Canadian native, and following his return to Canada, he accepted a position with the Ministry of Finance under the Liberal Party led by Pierre Elliott Trudeau government, which at the time was actively engaged with the U.S. Congress on the North American Auto Industry Trade Agreement. This subsequently led to the coordination and coordinated government corporate refinancing of the Chrysler Corporation. In 1988, he formed his own private consulting practice in Toronto, where he consulted with Canadian and US auto industries, focused on topics such as trade, tax policy, and free trade and foreign investment. He continues with that consulting practice today. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen, and thank you for having me today. And I'm delighted to join you to talk about some of the topics that you've covered in your introduction. And I think there's probably no better place to start this conversation than probably talking about Europe and some of its current challenges. I'm also going to talk about some of the global topics and factors that I think are influencing business decisions today, And as we move forward, are obviously going to play an important role in shaping, you know, how we formulate, you know, business decisions, you know, in the near and immediate future. But to start this conversation, I think, you know, what we should mention, following on, you know, your introduction, and that is that one of the primary drivers of the European economy is Europe's working age population, which is set to shrink, and you know, while we're seeing some productivity, those productivity gains are relatively small, and Germany and Europe are not alone. Canada is also facing similar challenges as well with respect to productivity, and we have lost significant ground in this area, and it has to be addressed at some point as well. But businesses complain that bureaucracy is also increasing, making them less competitive. We hear that a lot these days. And of course, the Eurozone's integration into an economic union has stalled. And you know, this is with little apparent political will to move forward. And we've seen certainly some changes take place in some of the larger members of the EU and so forth. But you know, we're certainly at an interesting time, and certainly we are at a crossroads, I think. The European Commission now puts the bloc's potential growth at less than 1.5%, probably shrinking to 1.2% by 2027, and a decline from 2 to 2.5% at the turn of the century, and due mainly to demographic shifts and weak efficiency gains. In other words, we're not keeping pace with productivity. We're falling behind, and Europe is facing the same experiences that North America is facing, perhaps with the exception of the U.S. And we'll talk about the U.S. a little later on, but you know, growth in the United States is seen at around 1.8%, and it's holding steady. So you know, the world's largest economy is certainly seems to be coming out of a period of tightening monetary policy led by the Fed. We've seen the effect of this on all aspects of business, and for that matter, you know, our lives as we live today. But what I want to do is I want to break down the topics which will probably shape global business, Stephen. You know, we stand at the crossroads of a rapidly evolving global landscape. The future of international business is teeming with unprecedented opportunities and challenges. But let's start with the digital revolution. We're all aware of this.
Before you do it, Michael, I wanted to ask, you talked to me I met you a few weeks back. I've known you, by the way, just to divulge this, I've known this fellow for 30, 40 years nearly. But Michael, you shocked me. It didn't shock me, but you told me, it was the way you told me this a couple of weeks ago. You said you'd just been in Germany. You'd been physically in Germany doing business. And you said to me when you came back, things are desperate over there. What was it that you saw, that you experienced, that you seemed shocked? I'd never seen you before react this way about, you know, such a large country. What was it that triggered you to think that way in that visit, in your recent visit? Just give us that in a nutshell.
Well, you know, the best place to start this conversation is to provide some context, even, you know, and then I will come to what I see as some of the current challenges and some of the events which are reshaping the German economy. But you can't start this conversation without recognizing that for much of the past two decades, the German economy has been a juggernaut. I mean, of economic power. I mean, rather than hollow out like so many other major economies. Its manufacturing sector was bolstered by industrial heavyweights. You know, the Volkswagen Group, the Siemens Group, the Continental AG, for example. I could go on here. Mercedes-Benz and hundreds of small, often family-run enterprises that specialized in complex goods, you know, honed over decades. We're talking literally about thousands upon thousands of businesses that have been in existence for 20, 30, you know, post-war period, 40-odd years. I mean, Germany shipped out billions of dollars of luxury vehicles, machinery, and other products to the world every month. You know, leading to hefty trade surpluses. I think right now Canada imports something approximating $22 billion of goods and services, but primarily goods from Germany in 2023. Meanwhile, we export to Germany probably no more than $8 billion. So you can see certainly the trade imbalance that exists there. But you know, Germany certainly has a hefty trade surplus, and this certainly has affected, I think, our ability to compete in the German market. What I'm also seeing, and I'm trying to answer the second part of your question, what I'm also seeing is a prevalence of small, medium-sized companies in Germany wanting to relocate. You know, there's an old saying that the capital will flow to wherever it can achieve the best rate of economic return. And invested capital right now in Germany, as an example, is not seeing that type of economic return that it has historically has experienced. And what we are seeing as an example of that is are some small and medium-sized companies actually moving to the US and other geographic locations, but primarily the US. And the reason for this is they're seeing the benefits of obviously onshoring and their ability to compete. You know, Biden's act of Congress that he put out in 2022, the climate reduction program, sorry, the environmental reduction program was probably one of the most powerful, you know, economic stimuluses that the US has ever seen post-war period. So Germany certainly is attracted to that type of investment climate right now. And again, that's within the context of the US economy, certainly showing signs of recovery when compared to generally speaking, Europe and specifically Germany.
Talk about the European Union and with Germany in the context of the European Union. I mean, what role does like immigration or migration play in it, in the overall European Union?
Well, that must be again answered within the context of a little bit of history with respect to Germany, because you know, Angela Merkel, who was the Chancellor of Germany for almost 16 years, was one of the leading members of the EU and the E20, and was largely instrumental and responsible for allowing immigration to come into Germany. And we all saw the effects of this. I think close to 1 million immigrants were settled in Germany in the 90s. And of course, I think that was important in helping to stabilize the German workforce. But we were also beginning to see these migration flows throughout the rest of Europe as well. But Angela Merkel really was a standalone leader in promoting, you know, this immigration. In 2015 alone, I think 890,000 protection, what we call protection seekers, were initially registered in Germany and supported by thousands of volunteers, with more than 1 million asylum applications being, you know, filed in the following 2 years. So this has helped to offset to some extent during that period, you know, some of the population growth factors within Germany. But again, Italy, France, and to some extent, Northern Europe certainly saw immigration flows change their population curves, and it's expected that some of that immigration flow will result in net skilled workers coming into important industries and eventually serving important roles within those industries.
I'm Stephen Armstrong. You're listening to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide online at CIUT.fm. Our topic today is doing business internationally during times of disruptive change. Our guest is Michael Blacklock. Michael, tell me a little bit about your background before we move forward. What's your background that got you into this? I mean, I think you do businesses, it's not just Europe, you're all over the world. Tell me how you got into and what kind of work you do.
Well, my career is a three-part play, if you will, if I can use that analogy, Stephen. And we'll consider it this way: getting early experience working in the 80s for a large U.S. multinational at a time when the U.S. was growing substantially and its industries were doing extraordinarily well, and working in the auto industry, which has always been a big economic driver of U.S. economic growth, was certainly an interesting period for me. That I would consider to be the first part of my career, and the second part of my career working in Ottawa and helping to understand the political environment at a senior level and helping to formulate things such as industry policy, tax policy, trade policy, and meeting, you know, heads of certainly most of large Canadian companies who would regularly come to Ottawa to discuss their issues and so forth. And for that matter, U.S. companies would often come to Ottawa to seek advice on foreign investment. So this certainly gave me, as a student of experience, certainly an interesting perspective on how government interacts with business and how it shapes a lot of business decisions through its policy work, good or bad, for that matter. And the third part has been my private practice, where I have worked with and consulted with numerous Canadian companies, European companies, and U.S. companies on various projects. I have a finance background, so some of the work that I've done has included foreign investment, bringing big auto plants into Canada, supporting those auto plants such as Honda and Toyota, General Motors and so on, Ford's. These are all important constituents within the automotive landscape here in Canada. So private practice certainly, you know, provided me with an opportunity to understand both government policy, how it influences business decisions, and to bring that together, hopefully in a cogent manner that I can share with clients.
So basically, your career, you had to have knowledge of the countries that you, if you were putting a company in from one country to another, you had to understand the regulations in which that company was going to perform in a country. And you had to understand the work and content of that company in its own country. So you had to understand the government regulations, you had to understand the markets, and you had to understand how to finance them as well. So you had a very multi-diverse business knowledge that you could bring to the table. Was that the critical value proposition that you offered these companies?
Well, thank you, Stephen. That's
You
probably
like
a good
it?
summary. Yeah, I do like that. That's a good summary, and I couldn't have put that perhaps in better terms. So thank you.
Well, I mean, for young people who are wanting to do business internationally, there's a lot to it. It isn't just a matter of knocking on the door and saying, "Hey, you want to buy my products?" or let's set up a plant overseas. There is a huge amount that one has to do in order to prepare the way for a successful venture. And so we have to engage experts who understand what's going on the ground, who can connect business people to the right financiers, to the financing, to the right government departments. I mean, I've just recently been exposed to a fellow who's taken his money from the US and putting it in his native Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire. And it came to my mind that this fellow cannot be successful without working with the government. You just can't do local. Would you agree with that? You really have to be some connection with the government when it comes to setting up plants and so on from scratch.
Yes. I mean, you're absolutely correct. Let's clearly understand the role of government at all levels, but certainly at national levels. I mean, they do formulate policy. They do, pass legislation. They do approve certain program work. They do what's called program delivery to support certain industry sectors and so forth. A number of factors also, come into this discussion. I mean, you can't take financing in isolation and say, well, it's a critical component, to any export supported or driven strategy. I mean, as I might have said earlier, I mean, the digital revolution has transcended borders, and its impact on international business is profound. We hear a great deal today about, as a result of the Paris Accord, environmental sustainability and corporate social responsibility, and these are no longer optional but imperative factors for businesses operating in the global stage. And I should also add that in an interconnected world, you cannot ignore cross-cultural competence. It simply is not negotiable. And you need that skill for international business professionals. So that's important. And another factor that's changing the business landscape globally are disruptions caused by global events. My goodness, we're seeing this being played out today in ever increasing highlights. But global events have highlighted the vulnerability of traditional supply chains, and the future of international business demands agile and resilient supply chain management, simply said. So, and lastly, coming back to this topic of geopolitical factors, I mean, a geopolitical dynamic continues to evolve, and businesses must navigate political landscapes with, if I can use this term, with the finesse of intersection of politics and business, and they must understand and respond to geopolitical shifts that impact international trade and investment. So when a business owner, as an example, Stephen, says, "Well, I want to market my products or my products and services to Europe." How does he go about doing this? What are the first things he should do? And you touched on this briefly, a couple of minutes ago, and You know, this must be a carefully thought out process, and it must take into account, obviously, government policy and those factors which are going to influence business decisions within the business communities, some of them which I've just talked about. And of course, you need to, obviously, it goes without saying, you need a business plan, you need your financing. And you need to thoroughly understand your business, and you need to thoroughly understand the market or the markets in which you think you can market to. I have met many businesses in my career, Stephen, who say they want to market to international or export markets, but they haven't done the prerequisite work to understand what their
Exactly.
value proposition is, for example, and whether or not they can, in fact, complete. Sorry for going on there, but go ahead, Darren.
No. Michael, we're going to pick it up. We're going to take a break now. And in the second half, we're going to get back into Germany and drill down into some details. So I'm going to play one of your favorite songs, jazz songs, Diana Krall. And we'll be back in a few minutes and we'll continue with this doing business internationally. We'll just give us a few minutes, so we'll play Diana Krall and be back with you soon.
Now you see you're lonely. You cry the whole night through. Cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. Now you see you're sorry for being so untrue. Cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head while you never shed a tear. Remember, I remember all that you said. Told me love was too plebeian. Told me you were through with me. And now you say you love me. Cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river for you.
We're back at the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz, and I'm your host, Stephen Armstrong. Before continuing to the second part of our interview, I want listeners to know about the Innovation Nation archive. Go to amgimanagement.com and select Radio Show. There's over 130 previous shows on many topics: artificial intelligence, leadership and innovation, advanced manufacturing, creative destruction, entrepreneurship, early childhood education, engineers, doctors without borders, multiple topics on people's careers and on various topics on, you know, that are shaping our world today. We're back with Michael Blacklock, and our topic is doing business internationally during disruptive change in the global economy, with a special focus on Germany. Michael, welcome back to the second part of the show.
Thank you, Stephen. Good to be back with you.
Okay, so you set the stage in the first part. I'd like to drill into Germany a little bit and talk about, you set the stage how Germany was the powerhouse of Europe post-Second World War, and in recent times has shrunk a little. And you talked about the growth, or the lack of growth and so on. I'd like to get into how the current state of Germany is impacting the European Union, and then maybe talk about some important political events that have shaped the current German economy. And the reason we want to do this is happening all over the world. So you're, in some ways, it's a cautionary tale for other international business people, you know, what to look for when doing business internationally. And we're just using Germany as an example. So go ahead, Michael, pick up with Germany again and its impact on the European Union.
Well, thank you, Stephen. A good place to start, really, when we talk about Germany is to really kind of grasp, you know, the size of the current economy, its population, and so on, and its its geographic context. I mean, Germany has a population now, I think, it was recorded in 2022 and 2023 of 84 million people. I believe that stands, I think, in third place globally in terms of population. But do you realize that if you took Germany you transposed it into another region, say in terms of Canada, it would occupy all of Newfoundland and Labrador. So in relative terms, it's a relatively small country, but yet it houses an immense population base, and of course, deriving from that, of course, has been its economic leverage. But over the past year, Germany has hit a rough patch. Its output has fallen or stagnated in each of the past three quarters, and the International Monetary Fund projects that it will be the only group of seven in the economy to actually shrink in 2023. So when you look at Germany within the context of the EU, you begin to understand what real economic contraction is taking place. I would say that a hiccup, if we can call it that, was unavoidable. I mean, now we get into geopolitics, but Russia halted shipments of natural gas to Germany last summer. And that deprived its producers of a cheap energy source. And that's been one of the big factors that's allowed Germany to remain competitive within a global landscape. Now, of course, China, which is a key export market for the country, is dealing with its own economic malaise. And I don't want to get too much into China at this time, Stephen, but I have read recently that some reports have suggested that Germany could reclaim an unfortunate title, and that is the sick man of Europe, and that's what it's facing right now. You know, this is not new to Germany, though. Back in the 90s, this was an economic problem and challenge that it faced back then, and even in the early 2000s. But again, we have to keep in mind that at that point, it was saddled by the weighty costs of reunification and tremendously high unemployment. But the Germany of 2023, 2024 is much different and stronger. So let's talk about, you know, the German government and perhaps its role, because now we want to talk about some of the political events that are.
But before we go into that, so when Russia halted shipments, that was the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. Am I correct?
Yes, you are.
And who destroyed that is all open to debate. But we won't get into that. I mean, we'll hear some people say it was the U.S. military, and some people will say it was the Ukrainian military, and, you know, there's all kinds of theories. But the bottom line is that destruction of that pipeline starved Russia of its cheaper energy source?
Well, it did, and you know, we can't ignore that without taking into consideration the role that Angela Merkel played as the Chancellor of Germany for almost 16 years, and the important role she played in maintaining, you know, important supply routes with Russia and, of course, obviously other European countries. But she was very capable of maintaining, you know, important key relationships with Moscow at the time when she was in power. And of course, this was critical to fueling and supporting the German economy, because cheap fuel was critically important to its steel factories, its automotive plants, its chemical plants, and its other related industries that relied heavily on energy.
So there's an important lesson learned. Politics matters, and who's running the country and who's making the decisions, and the relationship geopolitically matters big time for business people to decide where to invest in the long-term future. So you've got to keep your finger on the pulse of the geopolitics. That's what I'm learning from your experience.
Well, and to that point, Stephen, you know, the German government has faced a budget crisis after Germany's constitutional court ruled that tens of billions of euros, originally meant to cushion the fallout from COVID-19, pandemic, could not be repurposed for measures to help combat climate change and modernize the country. So, you know, all 2023 and 2024 budgets had to be reworked. And again, I'm somewhat of a fan of Angela Merkel as a political leader, because, you know, she maintained very tight purse strings on the German economy. And during her tenure, I don't believe that that Germany ever faced any substantial, you know, deficit in spending. So, you know, but again, coming back to your point, government policy leads to lack of investment in infrastructure such as rail networks and high-speed internet, and you know, this all of these factors have a direct impact on economies, and Germany, of course, is no different.
Where does this affect the greater EU economy? I mean, EU is 27 countries, but many of those economies are very small compared to Germany. I mean, and then the UK with Brexit, I guess, well, still, of course, the UK is still trading with the European Union, but Germany was the heart of the European Union. How does this decline, like how would this decline in Germany affect Ireland, for example, which still to some extent seems to be booming, but then that it's all to do with low taxation. But how will it impact Hungary, Greece, Spain, etc.? What do you see happening there?
Well, I mean, I would generalize my answer by saying that you know, facing headwinds, Germany finds itself in an unusual position. It's a drag on European growth, period. You know, for so many years, the continent could rely on its larger economy, that being Germany, as a steady source of expansion. But the coming years could be lean, and that could hurt Germany's neighbors, which had benefited from its boom years. And, you know, so the future is somewhat unclear. And as we like to say in the political world, the House has not yet voted on the outcome for Germany in the next, you know, 2 year period, as geopolitical events continue to play out.
Is this causing tension and great dissension within the German political system? I don't want the program to be political, but is the current situation, is there a move, for example, to the right, a move to the left? Is what's happening in Germany? I mean, is there a political fallout with respect to this decline? And if there is, what might that be, and what might impact could that have in the future if there's political changes?
Well, You know, Germany doesn't stand alone when it comes to political, influences and political movements. I mean, we are seeing, obviously right-leaning political movements taking place in several important economies and countries. Germany is certainly not alone. I mean, it has long been considered a equivalent to our NDP government here in Canada, elected by the people, run by the people, governed by the people, and a government that ultimately listens, to us people. So this is not unique to Germany, and I think that yes, we're seeing all sorts of news come out of Germany about some of these movements taking place. I can't predict what future is going to hold, much as I can't predict the future of what's going to happen in other important elections coming up, and how these political movements are going to influence some of those outcomes.
Would you be cautious now if you investing your own money in a new startup, for example, in Germany? Would you are you afraid? I mean, I'm just trying to take the pulse of you personally, given what's happening in Germany, given the uncertainty, given the disruption, would you still encourage business, international business people to consider Germany at this time, or would you say wait a little bit to see how things unfold?
Well, let me give you a two-part answer on that. If I was personally looking at Germany and investing, I think I would probably take a pass at this present time, given the uncertainty. But the second part of my answer to that is, if I was a business person and I wanted to expand my markets and its opportunities, and I wanted to consider Germany, then I will begin to do, my research, with respect to whether or not this is a market that I could either one compete in, or would opportunities present themselves for me to possibly partner with a company that's in Germany that wants to enter the North American market, and would this present a partnering, or would partnering opportunities present themselves if I did, my research properly, and of course then a number of other questions need to get asked, such as,
Yes,
well,
yeah.
what types of companies and so on. But we don't have to get into that at this point.
Yes, but that's a good answer. You're saying, okay, so maybe you wouldn't actually invest in money for production in Germany, but you may in fact work with them to bring in their products or services into Canada or into the United States. So it's a matter of how you look at what way the flow is. So all's not lost.
No, often opportunity can be created from certain, global economic events. If we're nimble and we understand our business and we're prepared to take certain, defined risks within our business model, then perhaps, opportunities can be explored upon. Again, I come back to my comment we made in the first part of this interview, Stephen, and that is that many companies in Germany are now trying to deploy their capital base outside of Germany, and are looking to North America as a destination. Canada has, I should say, Canada has trade agreements with Germany that allow for the import and export of goods and services with either reduced tariffs or tariff-free exemptions. So certainly, Germany has certainly an opportunity, I think, to expand outside of its domestic markets, and this could be an opportunity that could be expanded, with companies in Canada here that want to enter into partnering discussions.
That's fascinating. I get it. In Germany's time of turmoil, there could be opportunities for Canadians, for example. It's incredible. I'm Stephen Armstrong. You're listening to the Innovation Nation on Career Buzz here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and worldwide online at CIUT.FM. Michael, in our remaining quarter of the show, let's talk about the threats from China, etc., and rising economies like China, Russia, India. Talk about those a little bit on the impact of those in Germany.
Well, I think it's important to recognize what's happening within the economic landscape of China. And there's no better example of this than looking at capital flows, which we've been talking about throughout this interview. The German Hang Seng stock index, I think, has just recorded its fourth year of declines. Which is certainly a measure of economic activity within China's industrial base. We've also seen recently, if I can use this term, the collapse of real estate, caused by a low interest rate environment, a central banking system in China that's been quite pervasive in providing liquidity to borrowers, and now, of course, we're seeing the tipping point in China's real estate. One of the largest real estate companies,
Evergrande,
globally,
is it Evergrande?
Evergrande, yes, Evergrande has just been placed into receivership, and it's not clear. I mean, China's forecasting growth, I think, around 3 or 4% GDP. We here in Canada or in the U.S. would be quite happy with growth of 3 or 4% GDP. But China's used to growth of 9, 10, and 11% historically speaking. But right now, China faces some unique challenges. But however, what China is doing is it is certainly investing outside of its traditional borders, and then we're seeing certainly a lot of infrastructure spend and investing in a number of African countries and in some Middle Eastern countries. China's policy to create economic growth through these offshore investments is consistent with its doctrine of providing engines of growth beyond where it is now. But China is at a crossroads, and it is not in great shape financially. The question is whether or not the Chinese Central Bank or the Central Bank of China is going to continue to provide any bailouts to some of these large corporate Chinese companies that have now defaulted on their loan obligations. So I wouldn't particularly paint China as one of the large economic drivers. It certainly has scale. It certainly has relative to the U.S. It's number two behind the U.S. But challenges still remain, and this it's not it certainly is not a given that China can resolve some of these economic issues within its communist political regime.
Talk about a little bit. I think you have some knowledge on electric vehicles, both the production of those in China and the. I'm not sure if how that impacts the German companies like Volkswagen and Mercedes, but I think you have some knowledge of the role of the German companies in China and the role of electric vehicles, if you can talk to that a little.
Well, certainly the EV electric vehicle market is going to be one of the largest global drivers of economic growth that I think that we have seen since the post-war period. But of course, access to critical minerals and and other important materials needed in the production of EV battery solutions is going to be key to this. And of course, China has attempted to stake out a number of investments here in Canada, for example, with important mines and projects which are going to be critical supply sources for EV battery production now. But having said that, I read recently in the Globe, I think it was a day or so ago, that Canada is making big inroads with Canadian-owned mines that will benefit and play an important role in this continuing expansion of this industry. We've seen a number of EV car manufacturers enter this space. So there have been some failures in this space. But the Teslas of the world continue to have a dominant role, and of course Tesla have invested significantly both in Shanghai and in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So but again, we're beginning to see, that sector is beginning to see price competition coming into the market, and Tesla's having to respond to that by lowering the prices of its vehicles. How some of these plants will survive, it certainly becomes a question mark. And there are other potential EV disruptors that are entering the market, which are going to drive price, within this sector. So these are going to be an interesting 2 to 3 year period as we begin to kind of build out some maturity within the EV auto industry sector.
What is it? Is it lithium that can, like, what's Canada's, what do we have in Canada with respect to the raw materials required that serve the EV? Is it lithium?
Well, it's a combination. Lithium is one of the large components. Nickel is another important component. Copper is an important component. Zinc is another important component that's important. All of these minerals, are mined currently in Canada. Now, China has, I believe, some interest in some of these mines in Canada, but we have to rely on Ottawa to ensure I'm not in favor of protecting industries with tariff barriers and so forth, Stephen, but I think we have to look at foreign investment in Canada by some of these regimes such as China, and we have to be careful in terms of what we approve, so that we don't begin to lose these important industries to those countries and regimes which we don't support politically.
Michael, if Canada has the raw materials, why aren't we able to have a big EV manufacturing capacity in Canada? Like, I don't think we have. Maybe we have, I don't know. But I don't see the big EV plants around the Greater Toronto Area, for example. Why is that?
Well, we have a number of couple of plants which are going in. Of course, we've got this large plant in Windsor, which is under construction at the present time. But Canada, or I should say Ottawa, has provided some pretty substantial concessions and subsidies and other inducements to build these plants. That's largely in response to Biden's 2022 Climate Reduction Act, which is designed to support and provide direct incentives and tax incentives to those companies wanting to put these types of plants in place.
So it's starting. Okay, Michael, we've got 2 minutes to go. In the remaining time, tell me about, I just want to get some insight into the US election, what impact it may have on the German economy, and well, basically, let's focus on the US election. What impact might that have on the German economy and on Canada, for example? And we'll wrap up after that.
Well, that's a very important question, Stephen. And my first response is to say I don't know. The U.S. Has current trade agreements with all the NATO nations and the EU. But we do remember 4 years ago when Canada and the U.S. Attempted to negotiate, its trade agreement under NAFTA with the U.S. and the challenges that were faced on that front. They weren't certainly productive, but Canada stood its ground, and we were able to at least negotiate an agreement which we could live with. Now the question remains, will Europe be able to do the same? One of the big issues, I think, with this pending U.S. election is and certainly this is the position by the current Republican incumbent, and that is, Trump is insisting that NATO nations and EU meet their commitments on defense spending, and he's drawn a line in the sand on this, and this could become an important aspect of future negotiations as, Europe and, for that matter, Canada and Mexico, begin to negotiate their trade agreements with an incoming, administration led under Trump, if that is what's likely to happen.
What would you advise then, Michael, with only 1 minute, what would you advise in turn, if how does an investor think about the US election and what to do? I mean, a close friend of mine said in his business during Brexit, he said, no matter what happens, Stephen, I'll figure out a way to work around it. That it doesn't matter to me whether Brexit, he said, whether Brexit, he's been a manufacturing company making roll formed equipment in Northern Ireland. He said, no matter what happens with Brexit, we'll work it, we'll figure it out. Is that the attitude you have to have? Go ahead.
Yeah, I do think so. I think all businesses have to remain flexible. They have to adapt to a constantly changing economic environment, to changing market conditions, to competitive issues, and so forth. Any business owner or CEO today recognizes those risks and those challenges, and I dare say that some CEOs and owners of businesses, for example, in Canada and probably Europe, are probably looking, at November 2024 this year, when we will have a new administration in the U.S. and how will these businesses become positioned to be able to compete or to continue to do business in this market? So they will already begin to, I think, develop strategies and ways in which they can continue to operate in these important markets.
Michael, thank you so much. We're finished. It's been a pleasure. Maybe we'll bring you back in another few months and talk about Canada, like make the focus Canada and the upcoming US election, and maybe what Canada should be doing in terms of competing in the global economy.
Well, I'd certainly be glad to, and I thank you for taking the time with me today, and I enjoyed chatting with you, and I look to chatting in the future.
See you later, Michael. Thanks. You've been listening to Innovation Nation on CareerBuzz, Canada's unique radio conversation, empowers lives, enriches careers, and energizes organizations on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Stephen Armstrong. Any comments on today's show or with questions on Innovation Nation, or you wish to contact Michael Blacklock, contact me at samstrong@amgimanagement.com. An MP3 of this show will be available on the CIUT.CareerBuzz website within 3 days and permanently on the AMGI management website. Thanks so much.